Today on Maine Calling, the impact on Maine of President Trump's mass deportation vow. It was one of Donald Trump's central campaign pledges to deport millions of undocumented immigrants. He has vowed to launch the deportation program on day one of his presidency. That's in 4 days, January 20th. Individuals, government agencies, and organizations all over Maine are trying to figure out what this means for them, what their legal rights and obligations would be under an executive order. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will find out what they are thinking about and planning for, and how this is already affecting immigrants in Maine. For context, it's estimated there are about 53,000 immigrants in Maine, and of those, about 5,000 are unauthorized. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn, and by Maine Health, where care teams provide expert, coordinated care focused on your overall wellness to help you be your healthiest self. MaineHealth.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. How is the possibility of mass deportation affecting Maine? How are people preparing for it, and what's likely to happen? Joining me for this conversation, Lisa Parisio, who is Policy Director for the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, Aaron Fry, who is Attorney General for the state of Maine, and Adam Cody, a lawyer with Drummond Woodsum, who served as a member of the Maine Army National Guard for 21 years. We invite you to join the conversation. What are you wondering about when you hear President Trump's promise to deport people who are here illegally? How do you feel about it? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us today. And Lisa, I'll start with you. Give us a sense of what you're hearing from immigrants in Maine about President Trump's pledge.
Thanks so much for having me today, Jennifer. You know, ILAP is responding right now to a lot of fear, you know, in immigrant communities in Maine. And just to start us off with some context about how we are prioritizing our response, we need to look at the reality that mass immigration enforcement and deportation would not just do deep and irreparable harm to immigrant communities. It's bad policy for Maine, and it's bad policy for the whole country. And one of the reasons why that's true is just the horrible chilling effect that this has on communities and our societies from coming forward and sharing information that we all need to be safe and to live our best lives here in Maine and beyond. So what mass deportation, what mass enforcement means is it's creating an environment where we would see mass family separation. We would see businesses losing their invaluable immigrant workers. We'd see a loss of overall public safety, again, with this environment where non-citizens are afraid to have any contact with law enforcement, which includes sharing valuable information.
So Lisa, I understand that ILAP is among the groups opposed to the idea, but I want to know very specifically what you are hearing from the people you work with. And also, given that the vast majority of people here in Maine are here legally, that the estimated number of people who are here in an unauthorized way is less than 5,000, how is this pledge in day-to-day life, in the real way they're living their lives, affecting people?
Absolutely. So again, it's about the fear that people are experiencing right now, and getting a lot of questions about, you know, is it safe to seek healthcare? You know, is it safe to talk to the police? You know, what are the things that I need to do right now to protect myself? And one of the major issues that we're seeing is just, you know, the spread of false information, confusing information, and fear and chaos, which again is coming from the highest levels of our government and the incoming administration. So we're responding right now with just helping people seek out good sources of information understanding that everyone in this country has constitutional rights, no matter what your immigration status is, and just helping people prepare for the possibility of enforcement, those really practical steps. You know, what would you do in an emergency to take care of your child or an older adult? And of course, we're advising people to seek advice from qualified immigration attorneys. Find out what your options might be right now.
All right. Aaron Fry, turning to you, some other states led by Democratic governors have vowed to resist any deportation orders. Will Maine be one of those? Will it cooperate with an executive order, or will state government resist?
Well, a couple of different thoughts on that. First, I'm glad to be here with you, Jennifer, and with Lisa and Adam. Appreciate the time with your listeners as well. What is going to be paramount is that we are a nation of laws. We are a nation that has a constitution that provides for limitations on how the government might act. We have statutes in place, both federal and state, that guide, that order all of the ways in which people's rights are allocated. If there is going to be some effort by the federal government to enforce certain immigration laws, the laws say what's allowed, and there may be some activity that's not allowed under the law. And so right now we are responding. So some colleagues, myself, we've been thinking about what these pledges might mean. We are thinking about what happened back in 2017 with all of the different efforts like the travel ban and an attempt at some noise about birthright citizenship at that time. You know, we are thinking about what might come down the pike and what we have to respond to. But to directly answer your question, what we are thinking about is we are making sure we are completely up to date with what the law allows and doesn't allow. We are doing the best we can to prepare for what might be actions that abridge the Constitution or violate statute. Every single officer who's going to be serving in the government takes an oath to follow the Constitution and follow the laws. I'm going to trust that they will take that oath seriously, just like I do. There are going to be some actions that are lawful that are taken in order to enforce immigration laws. We understand that. But if there is action like going after, those who are lawfully here and trying to deport them in violation of those laws, birthright citizenship, which is clearly afforded by the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, if the federal government tries to abridge that, we do have a lot of effort going into thinking about how we might respond to some of these promises that were made during a campaign that really do sound to be unconstitutional. I will trust, however, that the sobriety of taking the oath of office will lead to following the Constitution and following the law.
All right, Adam Cody, you're a lawyer. You served in the National Guard for 2 decades. President Trump has suggested that he will deploy the National Guard to help with the deportation program. Can he do that? Isn't the commander in chief of the National Guard in each state the governor of the state and not the president?
Well, it's a good question, Jennifer. Typically, well, in the National Guard, they answer to two. National Guard members under state orders, which is the vast majority of the time, answer to the governor. If they are federalized, however, they answer to the president. And obviously, all the whether it's the reserves answer to the president, and also active duty soldiers. Now, we typically think of National Guard, excuse me, being activated for a hurricane, for a flood. Maine National Guard recently was activated for Border Patrol, however, in 2020, 2021, supporting Border Patrol activities. The basic legal framework, very quickly, is most people have heard of the Posse Comitatus Act, which is from 1878, and it essentially bars federal troops from participating in civilian law enforcement, except when expressly authorized by law. And times that I think if President Trump were to try to do this, whether it's with active duty troops or with National Guard, would use the what's considered an exception, which are the insurrection acts, which there are really two times that comes in. One is when a state requests help because of problems within their state. Think of the California riots following the beating of Rodney King in 1992. And then there are times when presidents have done it to quote unquote, enforce federal laws, and that's President Eisenhower enforcing Brown v. Board of Education, Presidents Kennedy and Johnson enforcing desegregation laws. These are times when federal troops were activated. The problem here, in my view, it's a problem, is the president has given broad authority to determine what is considered a violation of federal laws requiring the use of the military.
So it sounds to me like it's a little bit of an open legal question, but the most people think that in the end, yes, the president will have the right to call up the guard.
Well, the members of the military are required to support and defend the Constitution, as the Attorney General noted, but also to follow lawful orders. So I think the question would become and whether this would be considered a lawful order. And it would be a very difficult situation for members of the military. I'm sure it's being discussed at senior levels on what is considered a lawful order.
And you mentioned that members of the Maine National Guard very recently were deployed to the border to help with enforcement there. What about their experience maybe informs how they might be used in the future? What did they do down there, and what were the limitations of what they could do and what they couldn't do?
That's a great follow-up, Jennifer. They're essentially supporting Border Patrol. When the National Guard gets called into these types of situations, they're used as what's called a force multiplier, meaning they do supportive logistics operations or data management or behind the scenes, not the type of situation where they would be quote unquote on the front lines. Now that is more an arrangement that's worked out among the leaders of the National Guard and then the civilian law enforcement authorities, where the law enforcement authorities will effectively say, we need more people on the quote unquote front lines doing law enforcement activities. Where you can really help National Guard members is the support activities, the logistics activities, and those types of things. That's the most standard way to do it. And that's what the Maine Army National Guard did when they went down to Arizona. I suspect that would be probably what our leaders in the National Guard, if they were called to do this, would try very much to do, because they're not trained, so to speak. They're not trained in law enforcement activities. So I think they'd be very reluctant to take on that task.
All right. I want to come back to you, Lisa. You mentioned earlier that people you know who are here legally are already nervous so much that they may be missing doctor's appointments or not doing other things to take care of themselves. What are you saying to them when they tell you that?
I think a really important piece of information right now is just to remind people that the incoming administration is not in place yet. You know, that's not going to be happening until Monday. And it's just really important for people, you know, recognizing the circumstances, but to try to keep calm and again, seek out good sources of information. This is paramount in keeping yourself safe and your family safe. And it's really up to all of us to make sure that we are sharing only good sources of information. We're not contributing to spreading fear. We're not contributing to spreading false information to communities that are really vulnerable right now and are preparing themselves for, again, these threats of mass enforcement and detention and deportation that, again, would have just such a huge effect on Maine and the entire country in so many different ways.
Yeah, I want to talk about places that are considered safe spaces, and one of them is the schools. We reached out to the Maine Department of Education, and they sourced the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Department of Education. And here's a quote from them. All children in the U.S. are entitled to equal access to a basic public elementary and secondary education, regardless of their actual perceived race, color, national origin, citizenship, immigration status, or the immigration status of their parents or guardians. Current federal guidelines deem a school as a sensitive location or protected area where federal immigration authorities should avoid or must obtain prior approval for conducting immigration activities. The Maine DOE does not require school administrative units to collect or document information about a student's immigration status. Aaron Fry, I want to ask you, we're talking about schools there. Can the same be said for doctor's offices, hospitals?
So this was also an issue that occurred during the last Trump administration, where hospitals, courthouses, different places in which the chilling effect that Lisa was describing, there was some concern about what might happen if these became ICE enforcement areas. It's not just the location, it's also the information sharing that's going to be of some concern. So you mentioned hospitals, it may not just be the place, it might be the information that's collected in order to access very important life-saving, life-preserving services that that those who are in our nation are entitled to. And so I do expect, just like, because, and I say I expect, it's only because of the different promises that were made during a very energetic campaign cycle, and because of what we saw in the first Trump administration, that some of these places in which our society has considered to be safe spaces because of the importance of the services that are accessed there, that there will be new repeat litigation around how these places can be accessed and how they should be free from government intrusion while fishing for information that might lead to some sort of federal enforcement. I do expect there'll be efforts. I think some states are going to be more inclined to be cooperative than some other states. I think some corporations or some businesses are going to be more inclined than other corporations and businesses or healthcare facilities to cooperate. Going back to the first question that you asked me, Jennifer, we are thinking about what might happen if the federal government does try to overstep what permission it has to access information or spaces.
All right. Well, joining us now, Cumberland County Sheriff Kevin Joyce. Thank you so much for calling in, Sheriff Joyce, and help us understand what law enforcement's role would be or would not be in helping to carry out federal orders for deportation. Would you and your deputies be required to help round people up?
Good morning, Jennifer. Actually, that question is always asked. And the reality is this. Local law enforcement, state and local law enforcement, in my mind, have no business acting within the immigration laws. There are a separate set of laws that we have no training on. They have their own courts. Their judges are ICE, employees, et cetera. So having worked part-time for them, transporting immigrants back in the 1990s, I can tell you that as a law enforcement officer, we have no business trying to enforce immigration laws. It's possible that we come across somebody, whether it's being arresting somebody, and we find out that they're an illegal alien. But again, there's no way for us to verify that without ICE's assistance. We make a notice. We give ICE notice, et cetera. But I don't see us doing any arrests, roundups. We will back them up as we would any law enforcement agency if they need help and et cetera. But we won't be going out enforcing immigration laws.
When you say back them up, what do you envision that might entail?
Well, similar to, if the U.S. Marshals are doing a search warrant or something like that and they call for help, or a local police department will be there to make sure that the agent's safety is protected. But again, we don't have the knowledge or the expertise to be doing immigration law enforcement.
And I'm wondering if there are any kind of preparations underway among local law enforcement agencies for the scenario that marshals and immigration and customs enforcement agents do call on you more often for that kind of backup than before.
Back 4 or 5 years ago, we didn't see that. Generally, they're using Border Patrol, bringing Border Patrol down from the border to work on it if it's away from the border. I can't remember any time in my career where we were asked to be available in case they were doing a roundup, et cetera. So I don't see it, but, again, I'm not going to refuse to be there to jeopardize the safety of the agents if they call and needing help in an emergency situation. Have told them that my jail is pretty much full. based on my staffing. So they are aware that any lodge roundups can't come to the Cumberland County Jail because I don't have the staff to open another pod to facilitate as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in and joining us. Kevin Joyce, the Cumberland County Sheriff. We're going to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning about how different agencies and communities are reacting to the potential federal order for mass deportations, what is lawful or not, and what might happen in Maine. With me, Maine Attorney General Aaron Fry, attorney and longtime Maine Army National Guard member Adam Cody, an immigration lawyer, Lisa Parisio with ILAP, the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project. You can share your comments and questions by email, a short email, please, talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now, Mafalo Cheatham, who is Executive Director of the Maine Immigrant Rights Coalition. Thanks so much for calling in, Mafalo.
Thank you for having me.
I'm wondering if what the reaction to President Trump's promise is the same in different in all the immigrant communities in Maine, or you're seeing some immigrant communities more strongly affected by this?
Well, I think there is a sense of concern. There's a sense of fear, and there's a sense of panic, and that's really different in, you know, people who came through, the last 5 years because of all the rumors going around that will be the first ones to be rounded up. So you see that, you know, prevailing in the community to say you'll be the targets. We're concerned, but maybe not us. So you see that combination of concern, you know, some are concerned, some are panicking, you know, and just, you know, some are fearful.
Yeah, and how are you and other immigrant leaders preparing for this new presidential administration?
So our most important, priority is just getting ready. And so we've, you know, supported our communities during the pandemic. We've supported our communities as we saw increased number of immigrants come to Maine the last, you know, 2-3 years. And so we're going to, respond, you know, in a rapid way. So rapid advocacy response using a referral system. But the other most important thing is really honing on to communication and narrative so that we can really be ahead of misinformation, because the biggest challenge right now that we face coming into this new administration is misinformation and rumors. And so our work really is going to be, curbing those two things, you know, the narrative, by responding in time so that people have credible information. And so creating this network of where we're diverting and directing people to respective and credible sources of information, organizations, the ACLU, the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, so that people know where the information is, but the policies that are being, you know, shared are the right ones. And so, you know, working as a network and responding in a rapid way, you know, is how we are preparing ourselves. And so we've been meeting the last, you know, we've had two meetings now, and we'll be having another one just after Monday, you know, just to respond in a timely way. And so just organizing ourselves as a network, you know, so that we can support our communities.
All right. Mafalo Cheatham, thank you so much for calling in, the Executive Director of the Maine Immigrant Rights Coalition. We're going to turn now to Zach Hyden, who is calling from the ACLU in Maine. Zach is chief counsel there. Zach, thanks so much for calling in. During the first Trump administration, ACLU sued to stop the Muslim ban. Is this a similar situation? Is there a plan for fighting mass deportations?
Thanks, Jennifer. There is indeed a plan. As you noted, in the previous Trump administration, we took legal action to block some of the most harsh
immigration enforcement actions. Throughout our 100-year history, we've, as an organization, the ACLU has been devoted to holding the government accountable, to making sure that the government follows the rule of law. That's what makes this country great. That's why people come here seeking asylum. It's because this is a country that follows the law. But sometimes it's necessary to go to court to force them to follow the law. We're thinking about this in two broad ways. One is anti-discrimination law. So you can't discriminate against somebody because they look like they might be an immigrant or they sound like they might be an immigrant. That's illegal and unconstitutional. And second is broad abuses of power, which could be excessive force by law enforcement agencies of the federal government. It could be violations of people's privacy, taking action without a warrant, for example. But, whatever comes, just as Mufalo alluded to a moment ago, it's going to need to be a coordinated response. And communities in Maine and across the country are going to need to sort of band together to look out for one another. And I'm confident that we will.
Okay. What do you want people from immigrant communities to know about their rights?
It's, you know, as Mufalo noted, it's terrible that the threat of even these raids is having a devastating effect on communities. Nothing has actually happened yet, and yet people are living in fear. I want people to know and believe that in America, the rule of law matters, and the government has to follow the law. I also want people to know, and this is, you know, whether we're talking about schools or hospitals or workplaces, that, if an agent shows up at the door asking them for a warrant signed by a judge before they're allowed into a private area, that's not violating the law. That's exercising the law. That's applying the law as it's meant to be applied. And so that's an entirely appropriate thing to say to federal law enforcement, immigration agents. If you want to come into a private area, we need to see a warrant signed by a judge. If they have a good justification for coming into a private area, a workplace, a school, then they should have no problem going to a judge and getting a warrant.
All right. Well, Zach, thanks so much for calling in. Zach Hayden, Chief Counsel with ACLU in Maine. I'm going to go to the phones and go to Bob, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'd like to ask your panel a question. Both of my daughters are dating teenage boys who have legal status as immigrants. And I am wondering, will they be required to carry their papers with them at all times to show that they're legal? And should they carry just copies of those legal papers so that they can't be taken and destroyed? Well, what's their advice for my daughter's boyfriends?
Aaron, I'll turn to you. Should people start carrying papers, especially if their skin is not white?
Well, I was going to turn to Lisa. Lisa actually kind of hit on this a little bit earlier, which is there's been a lot of thinking about how to make sure folks are prepared in the event that there is some sort of action that would be targeting people like what have been described. Having all of your documentation readily available is good policy just to be safe. Lisa might have, and I think Lisa's probably providing advice to clients about sort of how exactly to preserve your documentation.
It's a good question. And of course, as with everything, we definitely recommend that people, you know, bring questions like that to a qualified immigration attorney to talk to. Generally speaking, people can and should carry the green cards if you have a green card, work permit. But just to circle back to what my colleague at the ACLU was saying, just remember and make sure you know how to exercise your rights. Make sure that you know that you don't have to answer questions and that you don't have to demonstrate your immigration status in a lot of different scenarios. So it's a little bit of a nuanced question, and that's some of the advice that we're giving out now. And we definitely recommend bringing questions like that to a qualified immigration attorney to understand your particular situation, how to keep safe.
Aaron, President Trump and some of those who he has appointed for top positions have said that they are going to, and I'm using air quotes here, go after criminals first. How How would that work? How would they know who has a criminal record?
Well, I'm not sure that they would, right? I mean, that's one of the challenges about trying to respond or trying to plan around some of these statements that are being made in the fervor of a political campaign, right? Is that they don't appear to be based on any evidence or plan that I'm aware of, right? Or that we're aware of when we're trying to figure out what this is going to mean for citizens in our nation. So in terms of going after criminals, in some ways, it feels like it's just a pejorative way of describing those who frankly might be here lawfully. Our laws about criminal behavior apply dispassionately. Doesn't matter if you're a citizen or non-citizen, they're just laws that you follow. I'm not sure how it is that these campaign plans are going to be rolled out. I do want to go back to something that we've heard multiple times already today. The government's actions are constrained. Sheriff Joyce, Attorney Hayden, Lisa mentioned that the government has to have a certain amount of evidence in order to act against a citizen because the Constitution constrains government action against its citizens. So I'm not sure how consistent with the Constitution they plan to round up criminals.
You're using the word citizen and that citizens are protected. There are a lot of people here who are not citizens, yet they are also authorized to be here. I'm thinking about asylum seekers.
I appreciate that opportunity to clarify. I mean, if you are in the United States, you are in the territory of the United States, you enjoy the protection of the Constitution, right? The Constitution it restricts the government's authority, right? It contains what the government is allowed to do. And this goes to the birthright citizenship idea, right? Like if you were born in the United States, the Constitution applies to you because you are in the territory of the United States. At least that is what the current understanding based on 19th century Supreme Court doctrines. So when I inartfully described that, I appreciate the clarification. If you are in the United States, if the United States government or the state governments are seeking to take some action against you, the Constitution applies.
Lisa, you wanted to follow up.
Thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to point out that, you know, there's this link that is being made between criminality and immigration status, but that is a false narrative. That is not supported by any data that exists. There is no legitimate underlying policy reason for mass enforcement. This is about white supremacy. It's about scapegoating immigrants to distract from the work that politicians are unwilling or unable to do to improve life for everyone in the United States. So, you know, we're hearing a lot of this, but I just want to point out that this is not actually based in data. It's not based in the facts. You know, this is an agenda where really the point is the cruelty. The point is spreading fear and misinformation and chaos. And again, that's why everyone has a stake in something like this. And that's why everyone should be paying attention, because, you know, harming such a broad member, you know, broad membership of our society does have a ripple effect for everyone through every sector of life in this country. So, you know, in addition to helping immigrant communities seek out good sources of information, again, it's on everyone to seek out good sources of information and to remember that these links, these false narratives that are being put out there, are part of another agenda and they're not based in reality.
I'm going to go to
just
Jake.
Jump in
go
real
ahead.
Quick,
yeah, please go
Jennifer.
Ahead. Adam. Yeah.
I think I would agree with the things that Zach and Aaron and others and Lisa have said and they're really getting to the issue of checks and balances within our country from the federal level, and then the federalism issues between the state and federal government. And I think that you are going to see a robust debate on this with people stepping up where there's overreach. I know, for example, soon to be President Trump and some of his folks cited the Alien Enemies Act as being a justification for sort of cracking down on relocating and deporting non-citizens. That was used during World War II, if you recall, to deport non-citizens of Japanese, German, Italian descent. I would note, however, where you will hear the big debate in this country is that has always been understood to apply to countries that are at war with the United States. So I think the justification for saying that we are, quote unquote, being invaded by immigrants is, despite using the campaign rhetoric, I don't think from a straight face perspective, people, Americans would agree that we're being invaded, despite saying we may have a problem with illegal immigration. But these are going to be the debates that are going to test our democracy.
And Adam, it seems to me that you're suggesting that even though Trump has said that this is going to be a day one mission of his, that this is going to be in the courts for a while.
I do. And I have sort of a bifurcated mind when it comes to Trump. He, on the one hand, tends to very much overstate what he will do, make these outlandish claims of things that he will do, and then sort of fall back and do something less and still claim victory. And I tend to hope and believe that when he talks about some of these things, that's really what will happen. My concern, on the other hand, when I talk about the bifurcated part, is that there were some folks in the administration early on that provided some checks. There was Mark Esper, General Milley, General Dempsey, and others that sort of would be the adults in the room, if you will. And I'm not seeing that necessarily with the current batch of nominees. And he's, going into a second round of being president. So fasten your seatbelts, I guess, is what I would say.
We do have to take another quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation about what mass deportation might mean for Maine, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We're talking about the possibility of mass deportation and what it might mean for Maine. With me, Adam Cody, attorney and former Maine National Guard member, Lisa Parisio with Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, and Maine's Attorney General, Aaron Fry. If you're quick, you can join the conversation. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We'll go to Chris calling from Biddeford. Hi, Chris, go ahead.
Hi. So basically, my question is, my brother-in-law, he came to this country illegally. He's since become a citizen, and he is very against the current immigration policy that we have. And on this program, I've heard several of the guests mention racism and how this is a bigoted program. So my question is, how does the fact that a lot of people who have come here illegally get citizenship aren't happy with the current immigration status, how does that tie in with that narrative?
Lisa, you're the one who said it, so I'm going to turn to you. Yep.
Sure. The reality is that the U.S. immigration system, our immigration system, is incredibly limited. It is incredibly narrow, and it is incredibly outdated. This is, example is kind of a unique one because, literally, there is no line for people to get into, for millions of people in this country to get into, despite all of the rhetoric. So, in some limited circumstances, people have pathways through the immigration system. But for millions of people in this country, we are still dealing, again, with this extremely outdated system that doesn't provide pathways for people to become citizens, even though they are here. Working, raising their families, making huge contributions to our economy and our communities, and are really American in every single way, except for on a piece of paper. So I would just, again, we continue to call on Congress. This is Congress's job to do the work to create a pathway to citizenship and to reform the immigration system, to create, again, that pathway to citizenship for the millions of people in our country who don't have one right now. That is the best solution for Maine. That is the best solution for our nation and for our economy and for the future.
Is there anything, Adam or Aaron, you'd like to add to that?
I just want to add, and Jennifer, when we talked earlier, this sort of came up, the way in which this conversation has been framed, both in the first Trump administration and through the campaign cycle is that it has provided people permission to discriminate because folks don't walk around with their immigration status or their citizenship status that they wear, right? And so, you know, you remember back during the first Trump administration where there was some comparison between those coming from Europe and those coming from non-Europe, who's acceptable, who's not. This permission to discriminate is an issue that we have seen bearing out in terms of how, you know, civil rights are being upheld, how folks, you know, when it comes to different anti-discrimination efforts. I think the caller's question, though, is about, you know, how is it that we ensure that our system is working for everybody and that those who are following the rules are doing the best they can? The reality is that is Congress's job. They had the opportunity to do it last year, by the way, with interference from a candidate for office. So they missed an opportunity to really address some important immigration reform. I guess that's what I'd have to add.
All right, Chris, thanks for your question. I'm going to go to Solange, who posts a question on Facebook. This is the question. Are places of worship considered sanctuaries? If so, can ICE enter them? Do any of you know the answer to that? Go ahead, Lisa.
Thank you. I can respond to that. Under current policy, the answer is that ICE cannot conduct enforcement at places of worship except for very limited circumstances. However, you know, this is one of the things that we are certainly on the lookout for on day one, whether there is going to be a change to that policy and whether enforcement is going to be allowed at places of worship. And as we were talking about earlier, at schools and hospitals and so forth. So the answer is yes for right now. But again, that's why it's important to just follow good sources of information because it is fluid and we may see changes to that policy as early as day one.
I'm going to go to Christopher calling from Booth Bay Harbor. Hi, Christopher. Go ahead.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Let me start with the paperwork documentation scenario. I'm retired Army. I don't go anywhere without my documentation, my DD-214 retirement paperwork, just in case I ever need it. So I would think if I were an illegal immigrant or an immigrant of any such, I would carry my paperwork with me just in case. But of course, that's just me. Second to that, I can't remember her name, but the young lady mentioned, you know, everybody being aware, listening, paying attention. Unfortunately, as I was listening to NPR the other day, they, you know, they made the point that the administration is attempting to shut down public, main public, national public radio, et cetera, Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So there are so many folks out there who don't listen. You know, we're hearing it now. Yes, that's great. But there are so many other individuals out there who are listening to those other entities, of which I won't mention. Last but not least, do we here in the state of Maine, are we ready for the onslaught, if you will, for the need for immigration attorneys? You know, it's hard enough now just to get an attorney for any reason in the state of Maine. The indigent, just the everyday people. Now with this facing us in the state of Maine, are we ready for that by way of attorneys?
Christopher, really interesting points. I'm going to start with your first one and go to Adam because you also have a military background. Boy, it would be a whole different America if all of us walked around with all of our papers, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. I think Christopher raises some important points. I would say that with respect to the issue of attorneys, I know ILAP here in Maine is a tremendous resource. And if anybody gets anything out of this call today, it would be to have them as a resource. That's something that we have unique here in Maine. I also know several attorneys who practice primarily in immigration law. I had one lunch with one a couple of weeks ago, and they are very busy. These are folks that work really hard, and I think, as I said earlier, I think our democracy is going to be tested on these issues, but fortunately, I think we have a history and a resiliency, not only here within the state of Maine, but within our country, to recognize historically the importance of not only a diverse culture, but the rule of law, as the Attorney General mentioned earlier. And I believe that I believe we're going to get through this, so to speak, and it won't be without challenges.
Christopher, thanks for your call. Speaking of the rule of law, I'm going to go to an email here from James. James writes, If the proposed next attorney general is confirmed, the attorney general will be a person who does not believe Trump lost the last election. How might that mindset affect deportation plans, which are based on law? Law confirmed the Biden election as president.
Well, we are a nation of laws, and going back to what I mentioned earlier, you know, I just took my oath for the seventh time actually as an officer here in the state, right? First in the legislature, and now for the fourth time as attorney general. I commit myself to following the Constitution. I understand that there may be some folks who are up for confirmation who are challenged with what facts they decide to govern their daily lives. But the Constitution and the statutes are what guide the work of those who commit to being officers of the United States and of the state that they're from. So people can hold opinions. That doesn't make them facts. It doesn't make them lawful. I hope that whoever is assuming their office is going to act lawfully. If they do not, and at least for me, if Maine citizens are going to be detrimentally impacted by having their rights not followed, I'm prepared to act, as are many of my colleagues, to make sure that the government and its officers are following the law.
An email here from Anne Marie. I attended a webinar offered by the Maine Council of Churches on Tuesday. They described a card for people to keep on your person, know your rights in many languages, on the ILAP website. So, Lisa, do you want to tell us about how to get that card?
Absolutely. If you visit ILAP's website, www.ilapmaine.org, on the very top, you're going to see a banner that has information about Know Your Rights and includes links to access materials like that. We are certainly advising people to get Know Your Rights cards. And just remember, you know, no matter what, you have constitutional rights in this country. As our attorney general said, you know, we are a country of laws. And to just keep up on learning your rights and using those great resources that are available to people.
Adam, I want to turn back to your connections with the National Guard, serving in the Guard for 21 years. I know you have many friends still, and I'm wondering if this is something that's a topic of conversation. Are people wondering what might happen?
I still stay in touch with a lot of good friends in the National Guard who have a diversity of opinions politically, certainly. Not hearing a lot of discussion about this. I've certainly read a lot from sort of the higher level folks, whether it's at the National Guard level or in active duty. I know that this is being discussed by military scholars, JAG attorneys, sort of preparation for that. So I would say it's more at the higher level, at the officer ranks, where the issue of a lawful order, as opposed to something you may disagree with, whether it's politically or you find morally reprehensible. I think that's a new conversation that's taking place. And as I mentioned earlier, at least with the first Trump administration, I think we saw some areas where, whether it was General Dempsey, General Milley, or others, where they were able to provide a backstop for that. And I think that's actively being discussed, probably more so among retirees, frankly, with a background in this, rather than folks that are in active duty or the senior levels of the Guard at this point. But I know it's being discussed.
And Aaron, we're almost out of time, but I understand in addition to ILAP's card, you're also working on a resource, correct?
Yeah, we are. Not only are we working to support those non-governmental agencies that are working to provide support, but we are also want to make sure that we are a good resource for people about what their rights are.
Mm-hmm. And I want to pose to you the same question I asked to Adam. I'm wondering if attorneys general from other states are in regular contact. Are you part of a group that's talking about what next?
We've been talking about what the next couple of years have been looking like for at least the last year. And we are regularly in contact about, our preparations and how we will support lawful actions and, how we will address those actions that we believe are in violation of the law.
Well, I really appreciate all three of you today for taking this time. I know there are a lot of unanswered questions, but a sense of where we may be headed, I think, is very important for all of us. The voice you just heard, Aaron Fry, the Attorney General for the state of Maine. Also with us, Adam Cody, a lawyer with Drummond Woodsum, who served with the Maine Army National Guard for 21 years. And Lisa Parisio, Policy Director for the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can find our past shows and sign up, very importantly, for Maine Calling's weekly newsletter at mainecalling.org. Tomorrow on the program, our guest is Congressman Jared Golden. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.